You're listening to Bums on Seats on Cambridge 105.
I know that you were planning to disconnect me, and I'm afraid that's something I cannot allow to happen.
You know what's wrong with you?
No, what?
Nothing.
Hey, would you mind putting that gun away? My wife doesn't care, but I'm a very timid fellow.
Since the United States government declares this man to be Santa Claus, this court will not dispute it.
I've got a good mind to join a club and beat you over the head with it.
No, no, don't do that. If you shoot him, you'll just make him mad.
I can no longer sit back and allow the international communist conspiracy to sap and impurify all of our precious bodily fluids.
Girls, come on. Leave the saving of the world to the men? I don't think so.
$10,000 for me by myself. For that, you get the head, the tail, the whole damn thing.
I heard what you were saying. You know nothing of my work. How you ever got to teach a course in anything is totally amazing.
Good afternoon and welcome to Cambridge 105 Community Radio in your city. Many thanks to Kevin Peters for the past 2 hours, but it's now 12 o'clock and time for Bums on Seats, your friendly fortnightly film fix. For the next hour, we'll be looking at both the must-see and the do-everything-in-your-power-to-avoid movies currently on offer at a cinema near you. My name is Gavin Midgley, and joining me in the movie booth today are Simon West.
Hello.
Kevin Hilton.
Hello.
And Mark Liversidge.
Hello.
Today's show offers both high and low cinematic culture, as well as a bit of everything in between. We'll be peeping through our fingers at the remake of Evil Dead, a gore fest even by the bloody standards of today's crop of modern horrors. Gus Van Sant and Matt Damon reunite for Promised Land, a drama about big business and grassroots politics in rural America. We leer and lech our way to the top with Michael Winterbottom's biopic The Look of Love, his fourth collaboration with Steve Coogan. And after last year's hugely successful The Avengers, Marvel Studios start their even more ambitious Phase 2 series of films with Iron Man 3, a sequel that dares to do something slightly different. Plus, we'll be investigating the rich and strange world of layering and surrounding yourselves with cinema, as Bums on Seats regular Sarah McIntosh talks to film academic and filmmaker Dr. Frederick Baker about his work with film projectionism and ambient cinema. That is all to come, but we start the show by swallowing your soul.
David. Please. Please. You have to get me out of here.
Leave this book alone.
No. You don't understand. There was something in the woods. And I think it's in here with us now.
We're gonna get you, not another peep.
At the moment, horror remakes are ten a penny. They're cheap to fund and have a name recognition bound to make back that meagre budget before the inevitable disappointing word of mouth breaks out. After bleeding dry, the reanimated corpses of the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, The Hills Have Eyes, The Omen, Friday the 13th, Halloween, A Nightmare on Elm Street and all the rest, it was only a matter of time before the studios got to Sam Raimi's seminal 1981 video nasty, The Evil Dead. This new Evil Dead, directed by Fede Alvarez, doesn't stray too far from the original in the simplicity of its setup. A group of five teenagers venture into the American wilderness for a short vacation, setting up camp in a run-down and remote cabin in the woods. They're there to help Mia, played by Jane Levy, through cold turkey, a final desperate effort to get her to kick her drug addiction once and for all. Along for the ride are Mia's brother, David, played by Sheila Fernandez, and friends Eric, Olivia and Natalie. But it's not long before somebody stumbles upon the cabin's copy of the Necronomicon, the infamous Book of the Dead, foolishly reading from its hallowed pages and unleashing the furies of hell, who promise the teenagers that they'll all be dead by dawn. Kevin, Evil Dead faces something of an uphill struggle, contending not only with a fan base that was probably more interested in seeing further sequels rather than a remake, but also with all that baggage of other horror remakes that have fallen at the first hurdle. Does this new entry satisfy both old and new horror fans?
It probably satisfies them, but I don't think there's anything that rich to be sort of taken from it. I think the remake was probably most likely was Chainsaw Massacre, which is probably the only other example of a remake that I've seen that I've thought it's fine if you've never seen the original, but it's certainly not an improvement. The only thing it seems to carry over is the over-the-topness. They've stripped back all the actual the comedy element of the original, but that does only leave the fact that it's an over-the-top horror movie. And I think the fact that there was some sort of comedy in the performances, in the kind of had a kind of old school joy, the old Evil Dead film, that it was kind of like very modern when it was released, but actually sort of nodded to like 50s schlock kind of horror, which was what I think lifted it above the pale. And this new one doesn't do that. It's just another over the top gore fest, but it's quite a serviceable example of one.
Well, I'll bring Simon in here. I mean, you touched on the humor issue there. Sam Raimi's original films did offer a certain amount of tongue-in-cheek humour, quite subtle in the first one, but then increasingly brought to the fore in the follow-ups. I didn't think there was very much humour here at all. What did you think? Was this an Evil Dead film in name only?
There wasn't any humour in here, in this film. That's one thing I actually quite liked about it. I mean, if you're going with the humour, you really do need somebody like Bruce Campbell in the role who could actually, you know, pull it off, who... After watching Evil Dead 2 recently, I was like comparing it to Chaplin, who's really, you know, that good at the slapstick. But this has gone back to the, you know, close to the first film, where there isn't much humour in it. It is more horrific. And I often think too many of the remakes and too many of the modern horror films have this requirement for humour, which, you know, makes you feel okay about watching it, make you laugh at the disgusting things that are going on. And I don't think that's always a good thing. I found this film very creepy, tense throughout. There wasn't any moments really relaxation. I had to look away several times, and I was just grimacing at a lot of things going on, which I don't get too often. You know, normally they're followed up by a joke, which kind of takes it away from you. So I'm not sure enjoy is a right word for that kind of experience. But I certainly, you know, enjoyed watching this film. I did get a lot out of it. It was dark, it was gritty, as the things you don't see, and I thought it was very well made, and actually had a reasonable explanation for the kids not to run away and to actually stay in the cabin, which is something unusual. It had the blessing of Sam Raimi and Bruce Campbell, and you can see it, you know, they cared about it, and I thought it was a really good film.
Mark, I was carrying on from that point. I think Evil Dead... I wasn't sure whether this really counts as an Evil Dead film for me, because it didn't have some of those ingredients from the earlier films. As Simon said, it's a horror flick. It's quite good stuff. But is Evil Dead as a concept just irrelevant now? I mean, we've had the spoofs. We've had last year's The Cabin in the Woods, which was a very postmodern take on the idea. Has it sort of jumped the shark, as it were? Have we seen this too many times?
I can certainly understand where they're coming from with this, in an attempt to try and get horror back to its roots. It's very much an old school, old fashioned horror movie. No pretension, no attempt to subtext or metatext. There's not any sort of parable or fable. It is just an attempt to be a horror movie and to scare the wits out of you. I would say, if you've not seen a huge amount of horror movies, you should get a lot from it. I think it would scare you. Me personally, I didn't feel there was much I hadn't seen before. And particularly in The Evil Dead, while it doesn't necessarily pull, thematically, it doesn't pull much of the humour through, there's a lot of moments from the original Evil Dead that crop up in this in some form or another. Unfortunate encounters with woodland, severing of limbs using certain household implements, and so on and so forth. There's a lot of touchstones back to the original. That, in a sense, made it a little predictable for me, probably up until the last 5-10 minutes. I think the use of practical effects rather than CGI is commendable. I think, you know, in that sense it had a feeling of reality to it. I just felt it was trying to justify its existence a little too much. With the sense of being, you must be in the cabin, I think there was a freedom in the originals of not worrying why you're in a cabin that this one got a little hamstrung by for me. But, you know, it's worth a go if you're a horror fan, I would certainly say.
Yeah. I mean, you mentioned the reliance on old-school special effects as opposed to modern CGI. Was that something that added to the atmosphere to you? Was that something that helped make it more effective?
I think old-school effects is always more effective. I'm not down on CGI, but so much CGI is really obvious. I think when you've got a monster that is so obviously not of this world, then it begins to lose me. But yeah, this was... The effects were fine, and there's nothing, no complaint about the effects. And so it was a serviceable horror film. It's just, it was no Sam Raimi Evil Dead film.
Sam Raimi Evil Dead films are, well, they are a very, very hard act to follow. So, but as you were saying earlier, it's probably one of the best ones about all the remakes. Apart from you didn't mention Dawn of the Dead.
That's a good point, thank you.
Which is probably the other best film of the remake. It's so much better than, you know, the Friday the 13th, I can't even remember, Nightmare on Elm Street, which, you know, suddenly become forgettable and kill off the franchises in the first film. But this one, it could go somewhere. It'd be interesting to see whether it goes for the slapstick route or comes back, because I know they are talking about a fourth Evil Dead film with Bruce Campbell, or an Army of Darkness 2, I think they're referring to it, which is, I think... That's fine, because forgetting just how different, say, Army of Darkness 3 is from Evil Dead and Evil Dead 2, they are three quite unique, different films, so you can't really have an Evil Dead vibe.
I think the intention, as Anna said, is that this is another episode in the same Evil Dead universe, so they've left it open for the two to interact. I think if they are going to go on with this, they have to keep finding ways of keeping it fresh.
Yeah.
Try and find a different angle. Yeah, it was good to get it back to that old-school feel here. But when you look at the originals and so many other successful horrors, they find a unique slant. Mm. I think this is going to have to work a little harder if it wants that unique slant, if there's a sequel to come.
And of course, we mustn't forget that Evil Dead 2 is technically a remake of Evil Dead, just for added laughs. So it has been remade before.
I think the thing for me is, if you took away the originals with any of these remakes, could you see it being remade itself in 10, 20 years? I'm not sure there's enough here that I would remake this Evil Dead. I think people would be going back to the originals as the touch point, possibly Evil Dead 2 as a.
Well, looking at the characters in this new version, I found it difficult to sympathise with it as much as I could with the original characters, and particularly someone like Bruce Campbell, who's very much brings the full weight of his sort of persona into that role. The new characters just don't simply have that appeal. And so you don't feel as much for them, I found.
No, I don't think any of them were particularly likable.
I think one of them wasn't even memorable. You keep turning up every so often, and you're like, I forgot you're there as well. I mean, like I said, as mentioned earlier, you've got to agree with the point that I think they struck lightning with Bruce Campbell the first time round. And it's, you know, very difficult to, like I said, strike that twice, so...
I mean, Jay Levy is certainly brave in what she commits to in the film, in the central role. But is she as interesting as Bruce Campbell? Nowhere near.
Well, I think we'll leave it on that note then. Evil Dead opened last Friday and is now screening at both Cambridge Multiplex cinemas. It is a merrily blood-soaked certificate 18. And if you're an Evil Dead fan, you will want to hang around till the end credits. And that's not the last time we'll be saying that this morning. Let's move on then to The Look of Love. A veritable Tasmanian devil of filmmaking activity, director Michael Winterbottom is a mere 4 months into 2013 already onto his second film of the year. April saw the release of Every Day, a family drama shot over 5 years, whilst this week saw the release of the equally ambitious but totally different biopic The Look of Love. Finding Winterbottom reuniting with Steve Coogan for a fourth time, The Look of Love is another in the director's tales of an outsider pushing against the system. Coogan plays Paul Raymond, once the richest man in Britain, with a fortune founded on the publishing of soft porn magazines and the managing of review bars. The film, adapted from Paul Willett's biography by Matt Greenhagen, follows the growth of Raymond's empire from humble beginnings to owning half of Soho. Raymond's unstoppable rise through the seedier quarters of 1970s London is paralleled by the simultaneous disintegration of his family life, as his wife Jean, played by Anna Friel, and other lovers leave him one by one. but he sees an heir to the empire and his lascivious lifestyle in his daughter Debbie, played by Imogen Poots.
My name's Paul Raymond. Welcome to my world of erotica.
Please do come along. You shan't be disappointed.
Was she nice?
She was just a girl.
Mr. Raymond, I'm here for the auditions.
He's got children.
One day you'll run the business. Be a respectable businesswoman.
Can't think of too many other people who have the relationship that we have.
She's gonna do this. Get the good stuff.
Would you say everything you touch turns to gold?
Not everything, but enough.
Simon, this is a story we've seen many times before on the big screen. A man whose financial success and extravagant lifestyle sows the seeds of heartache and tragedy later on in his life. Was there enough here to keep you interested?
Not really, no. I just spent most of the film wondering how, you know, the story of Paul Raymond and, you know, the fights against government and things like that could just be so boring. I think it was actually really quite a dull man himself, is all I got out of this. You've got Steve Coogan playing Alan Partridge straight, is what it seemed for most of it. There were a few humorous lines, but mainly it was just him quoting Oscar Wilde for those. He just seemed to be in the right place in the right time, and I mean, he made his fortune really, you know, from property and buying up the entire Soho rather than, you know, his pornographic publishing empire, which isn't an interesting thing to do. As you said, you see his relationships with the women in his life, and why they leave him, and it's perfectly understandable. He's just really dull, all flash, no substance, pretty much like this film.
That's an interesting point. Mark, I mean, this is, in some ways, this is Steve Coogan's film, and the film lives or dies by his performance. Simon obviously alluded to Alan Partridge there, and the shadow of Alan Partridge does loom over the character to a certain extent. Were you surprised by his performance? Did he pull it off?
I think he did about as much as he could with what he was given. He just really wasn't given enough to work with. And I was, by the end, desperately just waiting for him to sort of turn to camera and go, aha! Just to liven things up. I struggle to believe someone could have become the richest man in this country with as little charisma as Paul Raymond is portrayed as having. And there's certainly senses in the film where you get the feeling he's quite a shrewd businessman, and he's quite canny in the way that he manipulates those around him to get what he wants. And that's portrayed to a certain extent, but it doesn't come through in the character. And the one thing that the film struggles for across the board is characterisation. It has a large feeling of being a succession of things that happen to uninteresting people rather than a narrative that develops in any way. I think the only exception to that is possibly Anna Friel's character as the wife. It's a good performance by Anna Friel, and you actually do feel her character developing over the course of the narrative. Everyone else feels like it's an episode of a Brit sitcom with all the laughs removed.
I was going to come to the female roles in the film. I mean, as you mentioned, Anna Friel does a great job, but most of the female roles, if not all, are pretty thankless. There isn't much there for them to get to grips with, apart from perhaps Debbie, played by Imogen.
I mean, Anna Friel, she was quite good. She had some really good scenes, one or two good ones, where her acting talents were given an outing. But, Tamsin Egerton looked good, but I think that's all of her character really did for most of it. And I was trying to decide whether Imogen Poots was playing somebody who wasn't really a great actress or singer, or just wasn't a great actress and singer. It was slightly hard to tell the difference between them, which was kind of distracting.
It's a tricky issue, really, because we're dealing with, you know, the objectification of women, and so that's by necessity that has got to be part of the film. But how its approach? I mean, did Michael Winterbottom succeed in opening out that portrayal, that the use of women in that industry at that time?
I think there was a scene with a journalist where they say, where he's actually asked, you know, is what you do degrading to women? And he sits there and says no, and the entire room full of male journalists just laugh. And that's probably as close it came to even looking at that. You do have to, you know, you do wonder about the film as to how much of it was, you know, just objectifying women, but or then again, how much of it was a reflection of the society at the time and the work he was doing to decide, you know, what your viewpoint is on that. But it's not something that's actually dealt with. You don't really go into his court case. It's not a serious study at the of the time and, you know, how things have changed, relationship. Because, you know, he says that he loves women and he's got brought up around them, but you don't really... He may be comfortable there, but he doesn't seem to like them or anything, you know, which is kind of, you know, what you expect. But where this film could have been interesting, and other films like Larry Flint has been absolutely fantastic in the study in that, this just seemed to be very all surface, quite, and a study of a very dull man.
I mean, Kevin. No, not Kevin. Have you seen? You haven't seen.
I didn't
see
it.
Mark, sorry. I'll come to Mark instead. There are a string of other of cameos by comedians and comic actors in supporting roles. I mean, was that a way to lighten what could be quite difficult material, do you think, or did it actually distract from the story?
For me, it was a distraction because it's one of those films that puts lots of comic actors in what I would say are serious roles. They're just probably thankless roles. There's very little to them. So you get the likes of Matt Lucas and Stephen Fry and Simon Bird randomly popping up. Simon Bird pops up in a fantastic handlebar moustache and a big wig, and that's as entertaining as it gets. There's very little in beyond that, and it's the same for everyone. The one that's most distracting is Dara O'Brien, who pops up as a stand-up comic, who looks and sounds exactly like Dara O'Brien, and it doesn't feel like a character, it feels like he's been sent back in time. It's strange.
I assumed he was trying to portray an Alexis Sale type.
I did wonder whether he was actually Dara O'Brien playing Alexis Sale, but he's just credited
at the
as
right,
a comedian.
That sort of time.
Yes.
But that's the thing, and when I saw the credits, it's like, oh, I didn't know all of these people actually been in it, it'd be fun. And apart from Simon Bird, who's in two scenes, they're all in one scene. So I don't think, ooh, all these great comedians and all that in it, this is going to be funny, it's going to be good, because... They throw away. We've got Stephen Fry, the lawyer, and one scene, it's about one line, and that's it.
Yeah, we've got David Walliams, of course, who crops up as a creepy vicar.
He's got a couple.
Hang around
lines,
for no particular reason. I wonder if his role was cut.
Probably, I thought the best thing was actually, and it probably is worth mentioning when I've got time, is Chris Addison was quite good sleazy proprietor of the original Men Only magazine. But he was the only one who actually did seem to have character.
I mean, one of the big strengths of the film, I thought, was the atmosphere and the period detail that it captured, particularly in the early 60s. There was a sequence early on where, in a sort of fake interview, they were framed for a programme called On the Record, which I don't know whether it was around at the time or not, but it captured the style of 60s interviewing very well, I thought, and portrayed, and it was an excellent way to introduce Paul Raymond as a character being interviewed on screen for a BBC or... you know, ITV programme. I mean, did you like that, the flavour? Did you sit, you know, could you feel the sort of seedy atmosphere of these bars at the time coming from the screen?
It felt a little sanitised, if I'm being completely honest, which is odd for a film that's got an 18 rating, another with an 18 rating this week. And you can certainly see why it justifies the 18 rating, but it's all surface and there's no depth to it. There's no depth in terms of the characterisation. No depth in terms of the examination of what that means for society. You see society evolving outside the film on the periphery and us becoming more liberal as a group of people, but there's never really a connection between what Paul Raymond's doing and how society in general is evolving, and it doesn't attempt to examine how one is acting on the other to any great extent. It again feels like a horrible missed opportunity in so many ways.
That sounds like a good point to leave The Look of Love. It opened yesterday and is screening at the Arts Picture House and Cineworld Cambridge, and it is a Certificate 18.
You're listening to Bums on Seats on Cambridge 105.
You're listening to Bums on Seats on Cambridge 105, community radio in your city. My name is Gavin Midgley, and joining me in the studio today are Simon West, Kevin Hilton and Mark Liversidge. This year, the Arts Picture House is really making the most of having the equipment, screen size and trained staff to project 70mm. They're one of the few remaining cinemas in the country able to play host to the large format film. Last month, they showed Alan Parker's adaptation of Pink Floyd's The Wall, and next weekend, Sunday the 5th of May, there's a rare chance to watch a 70mm print of James Cameron's Aliens, one of the best science fiction thrillers of the 1980s. So if you like your facehuggers, xenomorphs and Bill Paxton panic to be as big as possible, then make sure to be at the Arts Picture House for 9 p.m. And as it's a bank holiday Monday the following day, there's no excuse not to go. As always, the Arts Picture House website has more information and booking details.
You're listening to Bums on Seats on Cambridge 105.
Whilst Hollywood studios and cinemas excite themselves over the profitable future of 3D, 48 frames per second and IMAX, some filmmakers believe that after only 100 years of history, cinema has just scratched the surface of what film is capable of. One such filmmaker is Dr. Frederick Baker, an academic who trained initially as an archaeologist, but whose groundbreaking documentary, Shadowing the Third Man, premiered at Cannes in 2004. That film, an influential blend of talking head interviews, archive footage, and clips from the Carol Reed masterpiece, helped Baker develop a technique he's since called projectionism. It's a style of deliberate film mashup that begins with the projecting of previously filmed images onto unusual surfaces that add layers of both texture and new contexts. Shadowing the Third Man, for example, projects Harry Lime's futile run through the Vienna sewers onto the curved walls and waterfalls of the sewer as it is today. In Cambridge to speak at the recent Watersprite International Student Film Festival, Dr. Baker sat down with Bums on Seats reviewer Sarah McIntosh to discuss distorting the imagery of the Third Man, true 3D technology, the atmosphere of ambient cinema, and Pittori, his ongoing archaeological research into the origins of cinematic storytelling techniques in the prehistoric Alps. But with a subject this densely artistic, it is always best to begin at the beginning, and Sarah started by asking Dr. Baker for a definition of projectionism.
Projectionism is a particular technique of using projectors to show picture within picture, the film within the film. And what I use is everything other than a film screen to project images on. And projectionism then loves the discord between the image in the film and the surface onto which you project. So I've projected onto the human body, onto snow, onto smoke, huge buildings, small buildings, everything. And I'm interested in that kind of border where the film image mixes with the surface of the world.
So how does that then differ from the idea of ambient cinema?
Ambient cinema is the idea of film as a 3D surround experience. So it's not 3D as an illusionism. The word 3D is used for actually stereoscopic film. That should be the proper word. For me, the real dimension of 3D and ambience is actually to have an experience where the picture is all around you and you are immersed within it, just like we're immersed in the world. And for me, that's ambient cinema.
Listening to your talk today, I sort of thought about how that, you know, well, I went off a bit of a tangent to do with like Arthurian legends and how, you know, they used to be retold but put in places that people had knowledge of.
One of the things that film allows you to do is to have different levels of reality and us to experience those different realities in a unified way. So we sit and we can see the film and we have an experience of a reality and characters like the Third Man, Harry Lime, but we are physically sitting in another time, another location. And what I did with projectionism was to take those images and sit in physically the exact same location, the same sewers, the same big wheel, but actually experience those two time layers and show those two time layers visually. That's, for me, the exciting thing. And so when you say you talk about reality, I have to say, well, those are different levels of reality. And the reality of watching a film is actually to be in two realities at once. And our brains can luckily cope with that because that's the act of imagination. And that is, of course, very, very powerful. That's why placebos work, etc., etc. So through the act of imagination, if the actors are good enough, they can create a link, an emotional link. So that even though, you know, you just have a sign and it says Rome, and nothing, we don't have any images that look Roman, but it just says Rome, and we then got Julius Caesar or whomever. If it's good enough, you are in the emotion, you are in the story, you are interested in those particular points. One of the great examples of this working is Dogville by Lars von Trier. And it's an amazing example of alienation and Brechtian work within a filmic context. And because Nicole Kidman and the other actors are so good, you are in the drama. You feel the mobbing, you feel for her when the community turns on her. But you don't need, you know, you don't need the expensive stage set, etc., etc. And for me, that's always been very inspiring.
I have to figure out how I'm going to get into my house. Or is that part of the punishment, having to sleep outdoors?
Oh, no, Grace. Don't think of this as punishment.
Well, is there anything to be said about reviving or making visible the projection as an art form itself?
Yeah, there is a kind of a certain mechanistic magic to this strip of chemistry, of being taken through but reanimated through the light. In my book, I call them fossil frames, and I make an analogy between each, you know, when you have an amber, you know, you get amber and you get a fly in it sometimes. That in a sense that Orson Welles is dead now, but in the physical frame of The Third Man, he's still alive. It's a fossil. And those fossils come to life through light. And the projector is wonderful because it's that reanimation machine. But it's not reanimation, as I say, in terms of just living and breathing. It's that particular cinematic experience. And that's one thing I've come to appreciate more and more, that the cinematic experience is something very special. You know, it has different rules. It's kind of like theatre, but it's not like theatre totally. It's kind of like a conversation now, but it's not. It's its own kind of thing. And that's why I think cinemas are important. And the act of seeing a film in a cinema is also an important act. And for that, a projector is there. And to have a physical projector whirring away is great.
The rock art of Valcamonica is an archive of 10,000 years of European history. With the use of multimedia, the Bitotti project has actually brought these images to life.
We have an exhibition here in Cambridge at the Museum of Archaeology and Anthropology called Bitotti, Digital Rock Art from Prehistoric Europe. And that's my work with Christopher Chippendale and colleagues in Italy. And what we've been doing is looking at rock art, which is 5,000 years old. Images that are hacked into the rock that can't move, but that we filmed and made move. And are analysing that as a form of proto-cinematic language. Obviously, I believe that there are elements of the cinematic which are older than 100 years of what we usually call film. And I deliberately use the word cinematic rather than the word film, because film is a historically, you know, Lumiere brothers and all of those. It's that sort of thing. Whereas the cinematic for me is something wider. If you come and look at the exhibition, you will see some of the images, some of the context in which I think you have people thinking in terms of story, in terms of image, in terms of place, and what we've also found out in terms of sound, the acoustics of the place, and where I think there was a kind of language was being used. But it's a language of space and image and time. And that's a kind of an exploration into the prehistoric beginnings of a cinematic language and a cinematic way of looking at the world. Because for me, the interesting thing is, what can cinema be? We've had 100 years of cinema basically copying theatre, you know, a proscenium arch. I call it tunnel cinema, tunnel vision. But for me, the whole point about expanded cinema was, hey, it could be so much more. You know, it's only 100 years old.
Cambridge 105.
Community radio in your city.
Many thanks to Dr. Frederick Baker for finding time for the interview after his water sprite lecture, and of course to Sarah for researching, conducting and recording the piece. Now an apology, as this interview was originally set to run last month when the Pittori exhibition was still on show in Cambridge. But you can discover much more about Dr. Baker's work by tracking down his book, The Art of Projectionism, which is available via various online book stockists, and or can be ordered from your local bookstore. And his documentary, Shadowing the Third Man, can be found on the double disc DVD special edition of The Third Man. And if you follow Bums on Seats on Twitter, we'll tweet out links to both the book and DVD later this weekend.
You're listening to Bums on Seats on Cambridge 105.
You're listening to Bums on Seats on Cambridge 105, community radio in your city. My name is Gavin Midgley, and joining me on air today are Simon West, Kevin Hilton and Mark Liversidge. As always, we are not even halfway through the broadcast day here on Cambridge 105. At 1 p.m. we make way for the expert blend of Italian and English, that is Radio Dante. Today the show is looking at the displays of Italian arms and armoury at the Fitzwilliam Museum. That's followed at 2 p.m. by 3 hours of running, jumping and standing still with a special Saturday Sports Zone. This afternoon's programme will be reporting live from Cambridge City's final game at the Milton Road Ground. That's all to come, but we've still got another 25 minutes of the show to go. We'll be wrapping up with Iron Man 3, but before that, we're heading back to rural America for a very different sort of story.
You guys have closed more towns than the team behind you by triple digits. How do you do that?
I grew up in a large farming community. Tractor pulls, cow tipping. We had a caterpillar plant. My junior year, they closed it down. And that whole farming town fantasy was just shattered. I'm selling them the only way they have to get back.
I am happy to announce we will be bringing natural gas to McKinley.
I can't believe this is right outside the city. It looks like Kentucky.
2 hours outside any city looks like Kentucky. Are you the owner of this place?
No.
Well, how come you're doing all the work?
You sign this lease, it gives us the right to drill on your land.
A whole lot of money down there.
That is true.
I know what you think.
There's no reason your town shouldn't have a state-of-the-art high school.
What kind of money are you talking about? You could be a millionaire. We're a $9 billion company. Do you know what we're capable of? Do you?
Despite becoming an unlikely global movie star, Matt Damon has remained loyal to his earliest collaborators, continuing to work with Good Will Hunting director Gus Van Sant on both his small-scale experimental films, like 2002's Jerry, and his more mainstream releases, such as last week's Promised Land. Written by Damon alongside co-star John Krasinski, Promised Land is a drama designed to focus attention on fracking, the controversial and possibly dangerous method of deep mining with pressurized water. Damon, at his most good-natured, plays Steve Butler, an engineer employed by an energy company to convince small-town America to allow mining to take place under their land. The latest town seems as much of a pushover as the last, until Butler finds himself up against a local science teacher, played by veteran actor Hal Holbrook, who demands the town balances the mining's potential economic rewards with the possible environmental damage. Matters are further complicated when Krasinski's environmentalist arrives on the scene, hoping to stop another farming community falling prey to big business. Mark, Promised Land attempts to raise questions about a topical issue within the framework of a personal drama, and this conflict between big business and small town values, combined with a tentative romance, inevitably brings to mind films like Local Hero. Does it manage to have its cake and eat it?
It felt a little bit stale cake, slightly chewed and then tossed in the bin, to be honest. That's probably a little harsh. There's a certain amount to enjoy from this. And you get a certain feel for particularly Matt Damon, Gus Van Sant collaborations. I loved Good Will Hunting when it originally came out. And there's a certain vibe of that film which carries over to this work as well. The biggest frustration for me is that fracking feels like a serious, complex issue, and it's wrapped up in the world of big business. This is more of almost a Capra-esque attempt to capture that small-town values and examination of a particular individual's character. And they just didn't mesh particularly well. I felt that the issue of fracking got poorly served, of exploring both sides. I think it would have been more interesting if actually they'd taken more of an approach of trying to look at Matt Damon and Frances McDormand's characters and make them even more corporate than they were. You know, they sit very much on the fence through large early parts of the film. I think there could have been some braver choices made. I'm just not sure that anything in it was ultimately well served by the direction it took.
I mean, as you say, it sort of combined the fracking issues with a larger look at the sort of financial crisis and fallout in America at the moment. Did you feel then that the issue of fracking got lost in the sort of the Capra-esque big business versus small town values?
Yeah, I mean, I can see if you're going for that Capra-esque feel, that you want to keep things simple. But I don't know that really does the issue of fracking too much service. I think because fracking is not a well-known topic, if you're looking at something like Big Business, everyone can get their heads around that and understand where you're coming from. I think because fracking is only now just starting to come into the public consciousness. In particular, the way that the film addresses the issue by having John Krasinski's character relay it to a group of schoolchildren. It's not a great statement about what you think of your audience, unfortunately. And that's about as deep as it gets in terms of fracking. It's very much a fracking's bad, okay, and Big Business is bad, okay, and unfortunately that's as deep as it is. I think then if the Caprask elements worked, I think if you truly bought into Matt Damon and Frances McDormand's character development, then you could probably forgive some of that. But because that never quite feels truly developed either, the whole doesn't quite work. I think you're just left enjoying some of the parts. Like Frances McDormand, John Krasinski's good, Rosemary DeWitt as the teacher in the small town that Matt Damon and John Krasinski both have a flirtation with, she's good. So there's elements to enjoy, but just not the whole.
What about you, Simon? I mean, was it a case of shooting fish in a barrel here, taking pot shots at Big Business? Would a Michael Moore documentary have done the issue better service?
I don't know. I thought it had a nice ambiguity to it. You do wonder. You do think Matt Damon's character does actually believe what he's doing for the right reasons throughout the film, which, as you're saying, it's not so much the issues of fracking; it's the saving of small towns that have no financial future, and which then gets brought up at the end about whether it's a good thing or a bad thing. When you realise that most people, if they get the money, won't save the town; they'll just leave. So it's kind of double-edged. But it's an easy film. I liked most of it, but it did seem very, very safe. I think I refer to it on Twitter as, we bought a fracking well or something like that, because it was Matt Damon doing a nice father. You know, I enjoyed his character, I enjoyed his acting. Hal Holbrook was one of the standouts. It was an interesting film. I was interested, I liked following the characters. It just seemed a little bit phoning it in.
How about
but
you, Kevin?
That's not to say, I didn't enjoy it. It wasn't anything much out there.
No, I think I'm with you there. It does have this. There's points of interest along the way, but it didn't distinguish itself particularly well. No. How about you, Kevin? I mean, was it guilty of... I mean, I felt like I was being clobbered around the head a couple of times by some of the dialogue. I mean, was it guilty of standing on its soapbox a bit too much?
Yeah, I think so. It reminded me, I'm going to show... the basis of my pop culture references now, but there was an old episode of Saved by the Bell where they did exactly the same sort of a thing, and it was just as deep or just as surface. But other than that, the performances were excellent, and I liked it. I liked the movie, but yeah, it wasn't groundbreaking. No pun intended. But
excellent pun. No.
But yeah, performances were great. Hal Holbrook was great. I thought Matt Damon's actually really good in it. And yeah, it was a shame to say that the talent was all there to make something really... It could have gone to the next level, and it just seemed very safe.
As a character drama, I'm trying to debate with myself whether it's successful or not. I mean, we were talking about female characters earlier, and some of the roles were quite thankless. How about Rosemary DeWitt's role as Annie, I think it was, who played the school teacher? I mean, was she a convincing character, or...
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I thought, say, all the female performances, they were good characters. It's a shame that there wasn't. If they weren't going to be, my feeling was, if they weren't going to be brave with the actual story, they should have at least been more bold with the characters and told a character story, because the actual fracking story wasn't. There was nothing new going on there.
Yeah. But,
I think the one thing that does feel like a missed opportunity is I understand that Matt Damon originally wanted to direct this himself, and then Gus Van Sant came in when Matt Damon was otherwise too busy having starred and written. I think it would have been interesting to see what Matt Damon would have made of this as a director, whether he'd taken a slightly different approach. You'd presume, because he was involved in the writing of it, that a lot of his intent has actually made it to the screen. I'd love to see what he can do with material like this in the future. But yes, it does have a slight feel of slightly warmed over Goodwill Hunting because of the collaborations. Even the Danny Elfman score feels like warmed over Goodwill Hunting score to a certain extent. So, yeah, a nice failure, I think I'd, you know.
I'll tell you, I think the problem with, it was really nice, likeable characters across the board. Just unfortunately, a little bit of a cliched film, which, it looked great, but it would be hard to recommend it. And it that's is, just on a Sunday afternoon yeah. film, I think. You know?
I suppose the biggest success is it's making me feel guilty being critical of it. Although, I have to stand by those
like
criticisms.
That, no.
Yeah.
It seems to be maintaining a theme throughout all three of the films we've reviewed so far, unfortunately. Promised Land opened last week and is still screening at both Cambridge Multiplex Cinemas as well as the Arts Picture House. It's a Certificate 15. Finally, on today's show, we're moving to the first blockbuster of the summer season, which unsurprisingly is also the first of numerous superhero films due in 2013. Last year's spectacular The Avengers saw several heroes from Marvel Comics, Iron Man, Hulk, Thor and Captain America, stars of their own film franchises, unite to defeat an alien invasion. The Earth saved, each now returns to their own individual adventures. Thor 2 opens in the autumn, Captain America 2 opens next year, but Iron Man 3 opened this week on Thursday. Co-written and directed by Shane Black, Iron Man 3 surprisingly plays fast and loose with the comic book formula. It opens with Tony Stark, effortlessly played once again by Robert Downey Jr., struggling with the aftermath of the events from The Avengers. But rather than rest and recuperation, he instead has to suit up for battle again, finding himself dealing with two new global threats: international terrorist the Mandarin, played by Ben Kingsley, and Guy Pearce's smooth-talking and possibly evil scientist, Aldrich Killian. After a very personal attack on his home, Tony Stark heads out to take revenge on those who sought to destroy his world.
I'm Tony Stark. I build neat stuff. I got a great girl. And occasionally, save the world. So why can't I sleep?
The Mandarin must be stopped.
You don't know who I am. See me coming.
What are you going to do about these attacks?
The whole world's going to be watching.
The question, where is Tony Stark?
Things are different now. I have to protect the one thing that I can't live without.
That's you.
Mr. Stark. Today is the first day what's left of your life.
Simon, Iron Man 2, made back in 2010, was made in a hurry and without a finished script, and was criticised for its rather flat direction. Does Iron Man 3 get the series back on track?
Oh yes, it's and more so. I absolutely loved it. I mean, the fact that I think they got Shane Black in to write it meant, you know, the script was sharp, it was funny. Great action sequences, the whole way the plot was handled, great, best thing about it probably is the second act where they take Tony Stark out of the suit for most of it, which meant you do get to see Robert Downey Jr. and it is his intelligence and his wit and sardonic, you know, humour and all that just, you know, coming through, and it's an absolute pleasure to watch. I mean, the film, it took no punches. It was brave. It was great. I mean, the big thing about it is, you know, it's a story and how they're going to handle the Mandarin and everything else. And it always comes down to the bad guys in here. And it's tough. And they managed. They pulled it off. No doubt it'll irritate lots of people, but they were brave and they went with what they felt with. And it you know, it has paid off. It's just fun.
Mark, as Simon mentioned, it's written and directed by Shane Black, who wrote 2005's Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, and of course goes all the way back to Lethal Weapon with his first script. Was he able to bring anything to the film of his own, did you feel he was confined by a sort of comic book formula?
No, I think he was quite liberated. It does seem to be the approach that Kevin Feige has taken with the Marvel films in his role as producer, of allowing talent to come in and to put their own spin on things. If you look at Kenneth Branagh's Thor and Joe Johnson's Captain America, you know, they all have a feel very much in line with the back catalogue of the directors involved. This is undoubtedly and unmistakably a Shane Black film, and it's all the better for it. It's up there with Shane Black's best work. You know, I would happily put this up at the level of Lethal Weapon or Kiss Kiss Bang Bang. I really do think it's that good. It's a joy from start to finish. I think there was a feel from the promotional material that it's maybe gone a little darker. Actually, that's slightly deceiving. There's an awful lot of laughs in this. There's an awful lot of joy. The performances are great across the board. I think the only criticism I could make is that sometimes the final battle feels a little confused in terms of the geography. Other than that, I can find very little bad to say about it.
Well, of course, it's his first film in a big special effects environment, so he's relatively untested, I think, in that aspect.
I think so, and I think coming into a world like Marvel, you must get a certain amount of nurturing and support in that context.
Yeah, I was reading an interview recently, they're saying they do actually have a school, and the first thing the Marvel directors do is they bring him in and actually give him a school, saying this is what you want to do, and this is how you make an effects-heavy film. So, you know, it's not like here the director, leave him to it. They do actually got the whole team, and Marvel have really got it down nicely about, you know, what to do and how, as you said, about getting the talent and letting the talent do what they do best and helping them if there's anything else they need to do.
Well, there's no question that Marvel are really on a roll at the moment, aren't they? I mean, I don't think they've had a flop or a bad film as such since they started this whole phase one, phase two. I mean, we're into phase two now after post the Avengers. But none of the films have been duds, I would say. And I think this is simply building on the strengths that they've reached so far.
I think the concern was that if you look back at the Phase 1 films, Iron Man 2 is probably the weakest of them, and by some stretch. I think, in my view, Iron Man 3 is better than any of the Phase 1 films. It sets a dangerously high bar for us to go on from now. But hopefully, with the roster of talent that's coming up, you know, we've got Alan Taylor's take on Thor, so hopefully a more Game of Thrones-inspired view. I'm intrigued to see what James Gunn is going to do with the Guardians of the Galaxy material next year.
We're getting into a whole world of future Marvel films.
Well, yeah, and it's just consistent with that feel of allowing people to come and play in the Marvel pen, but to bring their own sensibility.
They're not afraid to bring in new talent rather than the usual suspects.
Absolutely not afraid to take risks, and it's great and it's refreshing. And it's creating that kind of comic book sensibility in a film world. If you look at comic books, you know, comic books are almost the never-ending story, and you just get evolutions every few years of different writers and artists coming in and putting their own spin on the same material. And you know, the rules will be completely rewritten and then rewritten again in a couple of years. And you genuinely feel like that could happen in this universe. You genuinely don't know what's going to happen next. And this does actually, at a couple of points, take some quite bold choices. I think the thing you're referring to, which we don't want to talk about because it's a massive spoiler, but will irritate a few, but I hope will actually enthrall as many. And I absolutely loved it. I was, when it happened, sat with a beaming grin on my face in the cinema.
It feels very much like not just a comic book, but a Marvel comic book. It's got that sort of lightness, and there's moments of very innocent sort of humour within there.
Yeah, I mean, it's strange thing to say if you haven't seen the film, but I think one of the best things about it was actually the end credit sequence, seemed to ravel in the comic book, you know, clips from all three films and bring it all together, and with the score and the music at that point, it's just like, we're having fun, this is what cinema's about, this is what blockbusters, we're going to entertain you, and it's really entertaining. The only downside on it is possibly is that it could be Robert Downey Jr.'s last Iron Man film.
I was just coming to that. I mean,
because he's out of contract now, but nobody else could play it. He's going to have to sign up for more after Avengers 2.
And this is his fourth turn in the role, if you ignore his cameo in The Incredible Hulk. I mean, how much of the success of this film and the Iron Man series is down to him as an actor?
I think a lot of it is the fact that he pulled off the character. I mean, I'm a comic book fan, but when I went in to see the first Iron Man film, I didn't know anything about the character because I was always more DC. But he was instantly, here's a super rich businessman with no superhero powers, which is actually one of the biggest themes about Iron Man 3, is the fact he is only immortal. But it made someone who made you laugh, it was great, you rooted for him, even when he's probably not that nice a guy and all that, but he was, you know, you had to watch him. When he was on screen, your attention is on him and he runs with it. Which is probably, like I said, the best bit about this bit is a bit where he's not in the Iron Man suit and you have got Robert Downey Jr. playing Tony Stark, and it's just an amazing character.
What about the supporting cast, Mark? I mean, we've got a good cast of Don Cheadle, Gwyneth Paltrow. Do they struggle to sort of stand out from Robert Downey Jr.'s explosive performance?
I suppose the only one that I felt I would have happily seen more of was Rebecca Hall, who's always brilliant in anything she's in. I felt she could have had a bit more screen time. She's very good with what she got, but I think she could have had more time. But everyone else, Gwyneth Paltrow was, I think, recently voted the most irritating woman in the world, and this should go a long way to undoing some of that reputation.
She's also just been voted by people as the most beautiful person in the world as well, so yes. I don't think she cares about that one.
No, I think she's probably fine.
She's probably fine.
One of the other things was that you never quite felt the relationship between Rhodes and Stark in the previous films. It was Don Cheadle and it's escaped me who's played it in the first film.
Terrence Howard.
You never felt that they were good buddies. This very much, without trying to recourse too much back to the Lethal Weapon thing, you genuinely feel like they're two old mates. And Shane Black has absolutely got the repartee down between the two of them. And they both get their own moments to shine. Don Cheadle gets a huge amount of his own moments in the sun in the film as well.
After the first couple of films, if they talked about an Iron Patriot or War Machine spin-off, you would have thought, no, that's too far. But after this one, the fact they are doing it, you're like, yeah, okay, that's going to be good.
I would be disappointed if he's not in the Avengers 2 in some way, shape and form now. But you can say that of so many people in this. Guy Pearce is great. Ben Kingsley is outstanding. It's just, I can't stop smiling thinking about it now, which doesn't come across on radio. But
no, you're right. The humour is the surprising element, because the marketing campaign and the trailers for this film really sold it in a very different way, to the point that whole stretches of dialogue seem to have been replaced or rewritten and indicated a different direction. So you didn't feel at any point that you were cheated.
I must admit, I'll say when I saw Look of Love yesterday, I went to another film on Thursday. They had the trailer for Iron Man just after seeing it. I mean, my friends were just staring at the trailer going, sorry, well, that's the film you just seen. the trailer isn't the most accurate, but you don't care, because what you get is so good anyway, you just don't care.
It is another take on the universe, and it's another branching out. It refreshes the whole scenario again, but not in the way that the trailer is suggesting it does. It takes it in absolutely different directions. The fact that Shane Black can get away with making another Christmas movie and releasing it in April, and you just don't care, is just...
It does seem an odd choice for a summer blockbuster, doesn't it?
Yeah, but it's Shane Black.
Christmas voiceover. It's, like I said, he puts a stamp on it as well.
Yes.
Great. Well, I think that's all thumbs up all round. Iron Man 3 opened on Thursday and is showing in 2D and 3D versions at both Cineworld and View Cinemas. It is a Certificate 12A, and as I alluded to earlier, if you're a Marvel fan, make sure you stay in your seat until the very, very end. That's all we have time for on the show today. The Last Hour will soon be available as a Cambridge 105 podcast, available via the station website, cambridge105.fm, or follow us on Facebook or Twitter to get the relevant link, along with the latest reviews from the team. We'll be back at 12 o'clock on Saturday the 11th of May. Toby Miller will once again be in the hosting chair, with he and his team taking in a clutch of new melodrama, space opera and camp comedies. Pedro Almodovar's I'm So Excited finds the Spanish director ditching the recent dalliances with body horror and melodrama to return to his early love of flamboyant comedy. The crew of the Starship Enterprise returns in Star Trek Into Darkness, with Benedict Cumberbatch as the supervillain threatening the fate of the universe. And Mud is director Jeff Nichols' follow-up to his excellent Take Shelter, with Matthew McConaughey, Reese Witherspoon and Sam Shepard as participants in a southern adventure of lies and misplaced loyalties. We'll wind up today's show with Harry's False Funeral, part of Gertrude Herver's famous score for The Third Man. Please stay tuned for Radio Dante, but from everybody here on Bums on Seats, goodbye.